Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Wealth Tech Show, Citywire's podcast devoted to the technology that's causing a revolution in investing and personal finance. I'm Ian Horn, your host as usual, and I'm joined by Greg Guerin, Senior Product Specialist at First Trust. Greg and I have known each other for a few years now. Greg presents regularly at Citywire events. I wanted to bring him on the podcast as the feedback for his sessions is consistently fantastic. I've got to say that, Greg. It is, though. And more to the point, his presentations focus on technology trends and developments, the economy of the future, and how investors can capture returns through ETFs. So I've also brought Greg on the show as he's making the case for technology every day to investors like yourselves, some of you. And I want to know more about the conversations that he's having. So Greg, firstly, welcome to the Wealth Tech Show.
Thank you for having me. This is awesome.
It's a cool studio, isn't it? It's a pleasure to see you today. And firstly, can you get us started by telling us a bit about your role at First Trust and also why we should care so much about technology?
I believe in technology because I think it's pretty much been the bedrock of our progress since we started the first fire. And so what I personally do at First Trust is I help our sales team as we interact with advisors from around the world, but particularly here, we're focused on the kind of EMEA and Scandinavia and some other countries as well, talk to advisors about incorporating different types of investments into their portfolios. Particularly a big aim of our time lately has been talking about thematic investments mm-hmm. and really just kind of walking advisors through this. I'd call it a tectonic shift. It's just taking a very long time where people are starting to realize the benefits of, if you think about your portfolio as a pie chart, kind of realizing this modern portfolio idea of the FTSE and the Euro stocks and the S&P 500, and maybe realizing there's a bunch of stocks like Tesla last couple of years that just aren't represented in there. And then you get into a very interesting conversation around valuations and the opportunity of how easy or difficult it is to pick these tech trends, which I know we're going to talk about today. But talking about thematic investing has been a passion of mine for well over 10 years now, because I think some themes are very easy to spot. And then you look to your portfolio and it's very easy to see you have little to no exposure to that type of a theme. I know we're going to explore this a lot in a couple minutes, but that's been kind of the crux of a lot of the conversations we've been having. And that's across the board, whether it's Iceland or France or Switzerland or the UK, or even back in the United States, where this thematic revolution has been going on for about 12 years or so.
Yeah, for sure. And our readership has definitely demonstrated more of an interest in thematic investing in recent years. It's come to the fore, probably because of people like yourself as well. And when it comes to technology, I'm going to put you in a bit of an awkward situation here. Do you think people get it? Do you think investors, in the UK or further afield, before you speak to them, do they really understand what's going on?
That's a really good question. I'm going to break that down into two kind of ways to answer your question. So one, I'll give you a very specific example first. When we've been talking about blockchain, right? There's this deep desire to want to understand what blockchain is. How does it work? I need to understand it before I invest in it. Warren Buffett said, I don't invest in anything I don't understand, right? So there's kind of this idea that you need to understand things. And then it took a while because I tried to answer that question with my presentation. And then I sat back and I thought, and then I called my dad, who's a financial advisor in New Jersey and has been for 35 years. And I asked him a simple question. I said, do you know how to build an engine? And he said, no. And I'm like, explain the internet. He's like, well, what do you mean? I'm like, explain it. How does the internet work? And there's this spectrum of things that we both take for granted and don't understand, and the things that we don't take for granted because we don't know about them yet. And as soon as we learn about a new thing, they go onto this sort of spectrum. And so blockchain happens to be the newest one. And so because it's new, we expect ourselves to try to understand it. But if you go back to the internet, which is now 20-ish, 25 years old, I can't explain what it is. It's a very intangible concept, right? So then when you come all the way back to kind of your question, do advisors get technology? I think one way to think about it is a specific technology, right? Like electricity or blockchain or the internet or flight, right? Like, do we get those things? Another way is, do they get where the big technological shifts are. And I think that is a little bit easier to kind of end on, to just say, it seems like everybody's got their ways to skin a cat, but I've landed on three very big mega trendy concepts, which is a technological revolution in the digital realm. So a digital revolution, a healthcare revolution, and a energy revolution. And when you think about the world from those three categories, a lot of the other things like the metaverse start falling into place and gives advisors a framework of how to think about them and whether or not they need to understand, you know, from A to Z. See, I'm learning.
Yeah, very good, Greg. Well done. So I think you've, that's outlined the point really well. But you've touched upon something interesting there, which is, you know, people almost feel they need to understand blockchain to invest in it. And when you involve technology, you almost have to prove something twice over. It's not enough for it to be good and for it to work. People, for some reason, need to understand it. And I think it's because people are scared a bit. You know, there's a lot of risk involved, right? So are people properly understanding the risks involved, you know, investing in technology? Because you're looking at innovative companies aren't always the big ones, right? They're often small startups. They might not have been around for long. They might have scaled very quickly. Do you think people are looking at risk in the right way when they're investing in, you know, in technology?
Yeah, I like, so that idea of risk, I think there's something called the technology adoption curve, and you've got early adopters, late adopters, and then everywhere in between. And there's this idea called Crossing the Chasm. It's actually a pretty famous technology book. And the idea of what it takes to get the major part of the market, if you think of a bell curve, over the side, is either time or education. Mm. And both of those tend to happen, and they're happening faster and faster, right? If you want to learn about anything, you could just Google it, YouTube it, look at anything you want. And then it seems like books that are now being kind of more speedily accessible, if you will. It takes me forever to read a book. But now that they're on Audible and they're on 2x speed or 1.5x, you can actually read a book while you're washing the dishes or something. And so this idea of risk, I tried thinking about it a lot, just because when we were talking about today's conversation. And so I wanted to start thinking about investing in something everybody knows, a gilt, right? Some UK government bond with a 2% yield, which sounds amazing, right? And yet, it sure seems like we're probably headed to 4 or 5% inflation. And so while the bond will have a lower volatility, a more quote-unquote certain return, I'm also more certain I'm going to lose money. So that's really not the certainty I'm looking for. So when people ask me, what kind of risk do we need to take on board when we're investing in technology? It's like, well, what are we talking about?
Yeah.
Right? Because there's a risk relative to something else. There's just inherent risk with risking your money. This could go to zero, right? Mm. Now, it's unlikely that your government bond's going to go to zero. It might not be the case, you know, when you're buying a brand new metaverse IPO stock, right? And then people have it burned into their minds what happened in the technology bubble, right? And a large portion of the people, this all goes to the risk question. So I want to unpack the tech bubble real quickly, because this is like burned in people's minds that everybody got way too excited about tech, particularly about internet technology. And we can't do that again, right? And we don't want to do that again. And bubbles happen. But a couple other risk elements were present in the crash of the 2000 bubble that we need to be aware of. Number one, the Fed funds rate hit 6 to 7%. That's what many people think equities should give you. So when you could get equity risk premium for free from the government, it really causes people to reevaluate investment risk. The other thing was 9/11 happened, right? September 2001. That was right around that area. So I know that the tech bubble crashed, you know, 15, 18 months prior to that, where it started. But we need to understand kind of how the world changed and in terms of investment risk and the risks present in the stock market right around there. That 2-year period was not simple. So back to your question. When someone's evaluating technology and then technology stocks, I've been trying to be as clear as we can to set expectations with investors. There's two types of ways to evaluate this. There are companies that are already making money by already having sales in already proven themes. There's also buying speculative investments in new ideas that may or may not be profitable. And so first off, we have to segment these two things, right? Are we talking about something that's unproven and brand new and companies that have no revenue in that space? Or are we talking to something that we do understand? For example, something that's relatively new in history, but also pretty understood, e-commerce.
Yeah.
Right? So this is still a rapidly growing place in the world. The U.S., internet-based sales are only 15% of retail sales in the United States. Now, after the whole COVID pandemic.
Yeah, that
does
actually seem remarkably low, yeah.
That's crazy. I think we've crossed about 20 or so percent in the UK. I mean, these numbers could easily double and we'd still all think they were really low. So you can look at an e-commerce stock and then you can look at their sales and you can look at their profits and you can kind of get an idea of where we are on the J curve or the innings, whatever example you want to provide that. But that's really the big fragmentation we like to help advisors think about these technology areas as it relates to risk. Is this a completely speculative idea or is it an idea that's known, but the company is somewhat speculative in that they're pre-revenue or very low revenue? And that's where the valuation question comes in. And that's where the risk element happens.
Yeah, I was going to say, just to dig into the risk thing a bit more, you know, where is the legitimate risk? Because obviously you're looking at technology. Industries have innovations, have disruption. And the kind of the further you go along through history, the quicker the disruption happens. I mean, if you look at the energy sector, you've had all these emerging renewable energy types come through. But then what's the possibility that you invest in something and then the next big thing comes along? Is that priced in? And do you think, where do you think technology really sits as a sector? Is it closer to venture capital in terms of risk or is it more like a standard equity class? I mean, where would you put it?
Yeah, let's unpack that. So you talked about the speed that things are happening now.
Yeah.
And I think that is what is forcing investors to take earlier investments related to everything we just talked about. So maybe not buying something that has no revenue, but also not waiting until they've got, established company revenue status. And I'll give you a couple examples on that. And just to help us set perspective, I saw a note this morning that said, 20 years ago, we were told we could put 1,000 songs in our pocket.
That was 20 years ago, Christ.
Holy cow.
Didn't need to make me feel old, did you?
Right. No, I didn't. But also, how quick was that?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then on the way here, one of the biggest things that really, we have kind of this idea of pitfalls of thematic investing and these risks that people have. One of the big ones is kind of this thing called first world problems, right? And that made me realize how much time did we spend when we were kids or in the last 30, 40 years prior to 2001 making mixtapes or mix CDs. Mm-hmm. Right. And so this idea that someday you'll not have to do that sounds like a ridiculous idea, but it led to the platform that built the iPhone, which is also only like 14 years old. So the speed that these things are happening is kind of amazing. And let's jump into a specific one as it relates to risk. Right. So green hydrogen apparently is going to be a multi-trillion dollar market, 10 plus trillion. This is according to JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, but that's in 2050. But people want to invest in it now. So how is someone supposed to think about the risk of a company that has $400 million in sales? So taking everything we've been talking about together now, right? This company has sales. They are inside of a theme that people talk about. But the realization of the market is way off into the future. So at around $30 a share, Plug Power looks really relatively attractive to where it was in February when it was at almost $70 a share. But last February, 2020, it was around $3 a share. So it really helps set things in perspective.
Yeah.
And then you look at it and you think, well, they're also not making very much money right now, but they're in the pole position. And so last week, I mean, we're recording this November 1st, right? 2021. Yeah. The last week of October, there were a ton of really, really positive stories coming out, particularly about green hydrogen and fuel cell investments. So then it becomes a supply and demand issue, which is investors now who have disposable capital and are willing to risk it, and we can kind of have a spectrum of how much risk each of those investors thinks that investment is. And then they want to invest in green hydrogen in November of 2021. The best options they have is this particular group of securities. And the demand for that has just been shifted out based on the fact that all of these new positive stories are coming out today, potentially, as you just said, speeding up the possibility that 2050 maybe comes in 2040.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's, I think, just in the way that we were talking about it, to kind of bring both sides of this idea of risk and time horizon. Right?
Yeah, because that seems confusing to me in a sense that you're investing for 2050, but innovation happens so quickly that things can be usurped very easily. So, you know, where do you stand on something like that? Would you expect to have a holding like that all the way through to 2050? I mean, surely not.
Yeah, it totally depends on the type of company. So if you take Apple, Apple's a great example of this, right? Because if you bought Apple for the iPhone, so many advisors did this, many investors did this. Let's say you thought the rest of their business was worthless and you thought the iPhone was just going to cannibalize the iPod, right? Mm. So at that point in time, 2007, their business was pretty much the iPod, and they were transitioning to the iPhone, which when he held it up, September of 2007, no one had ever bought one. So their revenues from the product, their cash flows from the product were literally zero. But if you could look out and see this smartphone revolution, right, and kind of predict that, you would have been a very, very rewarded investor. Yeah. Right. And so then add in that because of the smartphone, things are taking place on a much more rapid timescale. Now, as we stand right here, we don't know how this is going to work even in the next month. Right. So I'm going to use a stock that is just, it brings up so much polarization. But Tesla, possibly what's been happening with Tesla is the rapidization of the rewarding of the shareholders. Potentially by seeing where the world is going, moving to electric vehicles and having those investors buying the stock years ago, right? And the whole idea of an investor buying a share, discounting future cash flows. And so I'll just drip in a couple other nuggets here real quick. It used to be the case that every time you read about Tesla's ridiculous valuation, quote unquote, you would read Tesla's now worth more than X, Y, Z, car company combined.
Yeah.
Right? Just this year, Morgan Stanley released a report that said by 2022, they think Tesla's going to have more EBITDA than than three major car companies combined. So I was like, oh, so it looks like those shareholders 5, 6, 7 years ago were discounting those future cash flows. They weren't just being idiotic shareholders investing in a guy they liked. Right. And so this, I think it's, I know we're kind of meandering around, but we're talking about two very important things together, which is the speed and the time horizon that is in front of the investors and the investment risk that's present. If you buy a company that never makes any money, you're going to lose all, you're probably going to lose all of that investment. So I'll always agree with that. But because some trends are readily apparent, and because of the iPhone and a whole bunch of other things like the internet and the prevalence of this information, things are moving so much faster that the market, quote unquote, or the market of ideas might be being realized faster than in real life. Does that actually make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. It's this idea of investing in things before they happen, catching the wave before it's broke. And it seems to be more and more prevalent, doesn't it?
Exactly.
But on that, there's obviously, you know, the kind of analogies that are always drawn when it comes to crypto, to bring that in, are things like the tulip bubble, dot-com bubble. It's always mentioned. How do you make sure that you're actually investing in technology that is a future trend rather than just the mania that's an idea that's never going to come to fruition? I mean, what can you do to make sure that you stay on the right side of that?
Yep, absolutely. And that's where we need to break it into the speculative technology investments or the kind of current technology investments. So let's set speculative on the side, right? Mm. So speculative are for passionate investors. Let's now talk about current ideas that investors are looking to invest in. We've set out a framework for rapid growth or technology investing. And one of the ways we've been encouraging folks to find themes or to evaluate themes they think are good ideas is to literally look at their own life. This is a famous strategy from Peter Lynch. You know, his wife came home. You know, in the grocery stores, not that anybody's been to one lately because I'd get a Cado. but at the end, you know, they have those end caps. Well, his wife came home and said, all of my friends are buying, I believe it was these pantyhose. And so he bought this pantyhose stock and he made a bunch of money. And he's like, I get some of the best investment ideas from my wife. But really, it's about looking at your own life, because that's something you have full capacity to understand. And you are not one person. I am a New York Jets fan, which makes me very disappointed all the time. And there's millions of us. And I know that we're all very disappointed and we like green. Like, these are just things that I know that are not just true about me, but they are true about people like me. And I can kind of extrapolate that. So what we say is, look at your own life, what you're doing, what your kids are doing, what your friends are doing, what people around you are doing, and then marry that with data. Right? If you get those two things, it's like your debit card and your PIN number. You need both of them to be true. I like sales growth, because sales is very difficult to manipulate. And most thematic or technology stocks fit under the growth side. Growth or momentum stocks tend to stop having good momentum based on sales. So this is kind of the first step framework. And if that's true, you move on to evaluating the profit margins or the business model and the cash flows. But if you just stick on the top front there, a great example would be if your vegan friend tells you to buy a company, go look at the company's sales growth. If it has no sales, then your friend just really likes that product, right? Right? And that's about it. But if you go look, and we just did this the other day, we looked at Oatly. Mm-hmm. Oatly had something in their recent shareholder deck, something like 82% five-year cumulative annual sales growth, 82%. And they're number one or number two in pretty much every market they operate in. Oh, by the way, they operate in Scandinavia and the UK and the US, all of EMEA and Asia. So I was like, they should have just written all. but like, all of a sudden I look at that, and if your vegan friend had recommended that stock to you, now it has some legs to it, right? And then you sit back and you think, well, what theme is this underneath? Oh, the pivot to plant-based alternatives. That seems like it's just starting. Right. And that's a way that you can make, I'm making a very specific point to talk about a broader idea. So whether it's electric vehicles or cloud computing or cybersecurity or digital transformation or the metaverse or cryptocurrencies, it's this idea of looking at the companies that are doing this idea, seeing if they have sales and if they're able to turn that into profits, or when they think they'll be able to turn that into profits. And then that all then wraps into the time horizons and the speed to which things are happening.
Mm-hmm. That all sounds pretty sensible, Greg, I've got to say. So to look at trends that you might be interested in, I'm going to give some context here. Some research from McKinsey, which was published quite recently, showed the top 10 trends for tech in 2018 to 2020. And it was based on venture money that was flowing in, rather than, in their words, the coolest, most bleeding edge technologies, which I think is quite adventurous wording for a report. I quite like that. They're usually quite bland. So hats off to them. But anyway, they picked out the following 10 trends, which are next generation computing, applied AI, distributed infrastructure, trusted architecture, the future of programming, the future of connectivity, the bio revolution, next level process automation and virtualization, nanomaterials, and the future of clean technologies. There's some long words for people that enjoy those. Anyway, so for some more clarity, or possibly to confuse people further, I'm not really sure. McKinsey also listed the technologies beneath these trends, which are the industrial Internet of Things, which in their words allows companies to integrate devices, sensors, and machines used for manufacturing processes, and to enable a common platform for gathering and analyzing the data these sensors and devices record. Second, there are digital twins, so NFTs, things that we were talking about, digital replicas of things in the physical world. Then there's 3D or 4D printing. And finally, robots, cobots, and robotic process automation. And I've got to say, I enjoyed this one, Greg, because a cobot is a collaborative robot. So, you know, you hear all these warnings about robots taking over and that kind of dystopian future. But I quite like the idea of a nice utopian one with cobots doing nice things. But anyway, I digress. But there's loads to be aware of, Greg. And while I'm most excited about cobots, clearly, which of these trends, because I just reeled off loads of them there, which of those interest you most, and which do you think the real innovation and the real kind of profit is going to be found in?
Yeah, well, let me agree with you real quick on the coolness of cobots.
How cool is that? Yeah,
it's amazing. And I learned somewhere in one of these books, which I'm going to talk about in a second, mm-hmm. that healthcare workers, particularly ones that look after the elderly, end up having terrible back problems. Mm-hmm. And this idea of cobots was one of the cobot ideas was that it's going to help healthcare workers who are looking after elderly patients be able to, you know, pick them up off the ground or pick them up out of bed or help them get up, help them get dressed, all these sorts of things that, again, back to that whole things we take for granted.
Yeah.
Right? That just comes with the job, quote unquote. Maybe it doesn't have to come with the job anymore. Maybe they can have a cobot. So there were things like either, I don't know if you'd call this a cobot, but just a robotic sort of system of levers and pulleys that the person can help get themselves out of bed, all the way to literally like exoskeleton type things where they would wear this and it would give them extra power and extra dynamism as they're helping pick people up. It was amazing. So to your point on cobots. I'm going to have to think about those really quickly.
I reeled off loads of them. It seems like the world of technology is suitably full of acronyms, which is and jargon, which is exactly what we want as financial services professionals, because it's, you know, it's not too much of a departure from what we used to, is it? But you know, I guess if there's anything you can pick out, what would it be as a broader trend?
Yeah. So the one of the ways, and this is, I'd like to do overlapping Venn diagrams, right? So when you've read The Second Machine Age and More from Less and Abundance or The Future is Faster Than You Think, and all these different kind of tech books, The Fourth Industrial Revolution, just started Kevin Kelly's Inevitable. What you end up seeing is a lot of the things on your list are in pretty much everything they're thinking of, right? And so when multiple people start agreeing on things, that's when I really start to take notice. And I'll give you an example of one that I poo-pooed and am now kind of raising my eyebrows, mostly because of our conversation and something I learned right about then. But if you go back to that, adaptive, or what was the word you said for computation? It was, I think it was the first one.
Oh, the very first one. Let me flip back to that. We had next generation computing applied. Is that?
Yeah. Because next generation computing and then adding in AI, this whole idea that in between the Industrial Revolution and the internet, I believe are the two most impactful innovations we've ever had. The internet being the most impactful innovation we've ever had. In between there, we got the computer, which allowed us to get the internet. Now we can deliver the computer through the internet, which is cloud computing. But it's this idea of all of the things we are going to be able to do. They're pulling up or tearing up my street right now. And I walked across this and asked the guys, well, what are you doing? And they're like, oh, we're adding fiber. This company in the UK, probably shouldn't mention their name, but got their little flyer. They're going to provide 100,000 megabytes per second. And I was like, that's awesome. Why would I ever need 100,000 megabytes per second? But you know what? 30 years ago when I was playing video games on my PC and it would take 4 hours to download something that was 16 gigabytes from that like 3x5 floppy disk or whatever, right? I can show age too, right? And I'm like, I just want my new Major League Baseball game to upload onto this thing. Yeah. It's those ideas, the things that we won't be prepared for simply because we didn't think they were possible because exponential moves so much faster than linear thinking. And I think underneath that, what's underpinning almost everything on that list is going to be a backbone of the computer scaled by the internet. Those two ideas in a secure manner enable digitalization. They'll enable the metaverse. They enable AI. They even enable robotics and those you mentioned Industry of Things. Yeah. And kind of pulling full circle some of the other things we were talking about, cloud computing and digitalization, cybersecurity, these kind of ideas, they're also not that new. And there's a lot of companies making a lot of money on them right now with really healthy growth prospects. So the investors don't necessarily have to leap into that AI industry 4.0 Internet of Things company that has no revenue yet. They can buy the cloud computing company that's going to be the backbone to that AI industry 4.0 Internet of Things software, right? And so that's what I think is so exciting is some of the themes underpin many of the other ones. So I have this little list called the Core Four, and I believe the internet, cloud computing, cybersecurity, and blockchain, which really is the internet, just in another protocol, are the core four technologies that are going to enable, by being the infrastructure of innovation, to almost all of these other ideas. And so I really think if I had to pick, it would be that first one. But when you start learning about what robots can help us do, I'll give you one because you also mentioned now the other pitfall. So one of the big pitfalls to thematic or innovative investing was that these first world problems thing, right? So you wouldn't give Travis Kalanick money because he tells you he's going to create an app to get a taxi. You'd be like, you're going to create an app that raises my hand or whistles real loud? Ridiculous, right? Billions, right? One of the other ones, though, that you just mentioned. And so one of the other pitfalls we like to talk about is exactly this exponential versus linear understanding. And companies that maybe have fledgling operations in a theme, those business segments might grow a lot faster than you think. And so companies like Amazon or Microsoft, 10 years ago, when we launched a product that invests in cloud computing, for example, everyone asked us, why is Microsoft in this? Mega company, tiny, brand new theme. How could that even impact the business? Today, it's a third of their cash flows. Amazon, people didn't even ask if they were in the fund because nobody knew they were doing AWS. And especially on their most recent earnings report, if they weren't doing AWS, it'd be a completely different company. Right. And so AWS is a huge percentage of Amazon. And those are $2 trillion stocks. Those are $2 trillion stocks, I believe. Right. And or right around there. And so the idea that you want to help investors avoid these pitfalls is companies can grow really, really fast. And just because you don't think they're doing that particular business segment, it's really important to kind of understand those trends can really start driving their business prospects. So kind of going back to your point of what are the themes, we really like cloud computing because it's inside the life cycle where they're already making money, but they still have really really positive growth trends right now. So they're growing fast, which investors like, and it's not a huge leap to see why what AWS does is important as it relates to underpinning all of those things. One of the other pitfalls that we had mentioned, going to robotics, and one of the cybersecurity experts we talked to a lot actually told me this. There's something called the IISSCC. It's the ISC squared group, something like this. They reckon that right now, literally right now, there are thousands and thousands of critical cybersecurity jobs that are unfilled because we don't have the people specialized enough to do them. Cybersecurity was the seventh biggest risk. Now the World Economic Forum has it as the fourth risk. Something tells me it might rise even more next year. And yet we don't have enough people providing this role. So a lot of people look at robotics and they're afraid of the idea. They think it's going to take people's jobs, right? But yet here's an area where robotics is actually going to be able to provide a gap to a current lack of employment that we have. And it's not taking somebody's job. It's providing a critical role that we don't have people to do. And so that's another just kind of interesting point on robotics, considering it, the way you even mentioned it was people are just so afraid of some of these technologies. And so kind of going back through these pitfalls we talk about is afraid of a technology because it can might, you know, change the world in a way you don't like, or the Luddites blowing up sewing factories and things like that, or the speed to where a company can make money from it. So the exponential digital growth element, and then also the first world problems. Those are just some of the things we think through.
For sure. And the cybercrime thing's interesting because obviously if something goes wrong, there's huge amounts of money at play. And there's also this move towards decentralized finance, which is a big part of wealth tech. And that brings me on to, well, obviously there's a big security opportunity we could talk about at length and probably should do very soon. But the last question I've got for you is around the whole crypto thing, because I think that fits in nicely here. If someone stole your crypto from your wallet, what do you do? I mean, it's all well and good talking about decentralized finance. When it goes wrong, you're probably going to want to speak to the regular police, like the normal centralized forces, you know.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about this world to some extent at our event in Harrogate, where we were looking at NFTs, and I realized you were at the dinner table trying to buy an NFT, which was a video clip from basketball history, right?
Yeah.
Although the Wi-Fi let us down and you couldn't, so that's we're maybe not quite there in 2021, are we? My question, Greg, is where do you think crypto and NFTs fit into the picture for the future? Because again, you were saying you don't have to understand an investment to invest in it. People sure as hell don't understand NFTs and crypto, do they? I don't claim to be an expert myself. So do you think that's going to become a big part of the investment landscape, or is it a bit of a distraction?
I really like that question. Again, let's bifurcate that into the crypto and the NFTs.
Yeah, that's a good idea, yeah.
Let's end on crypto, because I think we can have a really deep conversation about that. The NFT was actually the idea I said earlier I had been poo-pooing until we had that conversation. And so we made this blockchain presentation, and someone suggested we put NFTs in there. And I said, no, this seems like this ridiculous idea, right? Going, not even listening to my own ideas of kind of how to avoid these pitfalls. And someone made a slide, one of our amazing marketing people made a slide on this one NFT that was purchased by the former CEO of T-Mobile, John Laguerre, for about $900,000. And I looked at that and I thought, holy cow, a Picasso goes for this one Picasso we put on the slide, it was 1.1 million. So I'm sure we all know there's pieces of art that are worth less and worth more. But here you got an NFT. I mean, how old have NFTs been, right? So an NFT that's worth almost as much as a Picasso. But Ian, I would never buy a Picasso, right?
So, yeah, but it makes two of us.
But the reason why I thought it'd be good to start there is because that is part of very wealthy people's investment portfolios. So why would someone invest in a piece of art? Well, there's inflationary expectations, right? It could hold its value. And then it's like, well, why would a Picasso hold its value? And it's because it's rare and it's good, right? So it's good, but that's in the eye of the beholder. So the NFT we were looking at was like hideous, but the basketball highlight, very valuable to me, right? So all of a sudden, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. That's going to stay the same from regular, let's call it traditional art, to these NFT art pieces, right? And then you go to, what's one of the other things about a Picasso is if you can verify that it is rare. This is a Picasso. I can prove it. Well, that's something you can, against not just supposedly, but that is something you can do right now based on blockchain technology better than having a piece of artwork. I mean, how many Ocean movies do we have to watch to know you can steal art, right?
Yeah.
And so I found that to be just a very mind-opening conversation around, especially as it relates to investments. I mean, if John Laguerre is going to put almost $1 million into this NFT, and someone else would put $1 million in Picasso, and neither one of us would understand it, mostly because we don't have portfolio sizes that big, where you get a 1 or 2 or 10% exposure to real assets. I think those are going to fit into that real assets, or maybe you'll have real assets and digital assets, right? I think those will be the thing. But the whole point of blockchain is that you can verify rarity, and that's the only value that artwork ever had, other than beauty being in the eye of the beholder. And if you really want to look at this Picasso in your house, but there's only 5 of them, that supply and demand dynamic, plus or minus inflation, is going to drive that. So I do think real assets and digital assets, or if these digital assets will be viewed as that kind of real assets part of very, very, I don't know, ultra high net or high net worth investors, I think that's real. And it's clearly already a thing. Plus me buying some basketball highlights. Now that's just fun, right?
Yeah.
But onto crypto, I think this is a fascinating conversation, because when you look at cryptocurrencies as a group or cryptocurrencies in specific, the conversations tend to be very, very different, right? And just as a very quick note, people all the time, when we say we're going to present on blockchain, they say, oh yeah, I just heard Elon Musk buys blockchain. It's like, no, Elon Musk buys cryptocurrencies. Blockchain is the technology that underpins, you know, and it's this idea that we would love to make sure anytime we open our mouth on cryptocurrencies, it's very clear. Like email, utilize the internet technology. Cryptocurrencies utilize blockchain technology. And I'm sure we could get on a whole side channel there. But as it relates to cryptocurrencies, there's the speculative element from an investment perspective. And I think a really simple way to explain it would be the FOMO element of a portfolio. There's just a reason where I don't want my friend Matt to be super wealthy from this thing that I could also have bought.
Yeah.
And I'm not, right?
Yeah,
so it's like, if He could, if he, so if you just walk this through and what's, you know, that super famous portfolio manager, she thinks Bitcoin could be worth X thousands of dollars. And so if I only put in this amount, then this, well, there's a couple reasons why I would do that. Either I believe that it's going to go there or I don't. And then if my friends have it, I just don't want to be the one, you know, coming over to Thanksgiving, still buying the lowest level wine and coming over and it's like, yeah, I know. Let me tell you why screw tops actually as good as a corkscrew. like you don't want to have that conversation. So there's, I really do think FOMO drives a huge amount of this, the cryptocurrency investment. In particular, you see what type of demographics are investing. And we'll use the two terms, investing in or using, right? So investing in cryptocurrencies, i.e. I'm buying something that I'm looking to get rid of later for a higher value versus transacting.
Yeah. Actually, let me put you on the spot again here. Yeah. Investing or speculating?
It depends. It depends on the – I think because it's a currency, by definition, it's a speculation, mm-hmm. right? But then we're going to have the conversation of is it even a currency?
Yeah.
Right? So does it store value? Is it a medium of exchange? And is it a unit of account? Those are your three like textbook definitions of a currency. And you could argue about whether or not those are. Store of value, if it's that volatile, is it storing your value? But some people are buying it for the store of value. And that's where that question really gets really complicated. Because if I'm buying it for the store of value, like gold, for example, or the dollar or the pound, then it becomes kind of an investment conversation. Right. But I would say speculation, very much like if I were to go out right now and buy loads of euros. Right.
Yeah.
There's only one reason you're buying loads of euros. It's because you think that's going up. But if you think it's going up, why do central banks around the world maybe have a different idea? Or why do hedge fund managers have a different idea? Right. The idea that you're loading up on a currency, I think, makes it a speculative element. But the idea of transacting versus investing, it is important. And then inside that speculative investment, I've just found it fascinating that when all the inflation news started breaking in the second week of May for April's inflation news, and then it happened again in June, and then again in July, and then again in August. And in these last 7 months, cryptocurrencies lost basically 30 to 50% or more of their value. They've completed a complete U or V shape, whatever, I don't care what we call it, but it went from something down about 30 to 50% and has come pretty close to back. I think part of the, one of my joke responses was, so I'm buying Bitcoin, or as a fictitious person, right? I'm buying Bitcoin because I have lost my full faith and credit in the US government. I think they're just going to print dollars ad nauseum and going to make my money worth less. Therefore, I'm going to buy this digital asset. Okay. Then you realize Bitcoin's up 10, 20,000%. And headline news is a 5% inflation print, right? Yeah. So I think possibly the market maybe was like, wait a minute. What if we do get, what was the 70s? World, you know, shaking inflation in the US was like 15%. But Bitcoin's already up 15,000%. Something seems amiss, right? But then it becomes the supply and demand and all these sorts of ideas. So cryptocurrencies are such a interesting element of the next stage of life. But we have to bring back everything we were talking about in the beginning. Because if more and more things go digital, it's possible those digital platforms like Amazon, right? Or like iTunes, but then even more digital moving from here. They might require their own, you know, like Starbucks bucks,
yeah.
right? Or if you've seen The Office, Schrute bucks, right? The American Office, that is. But yeah, I want to come back to you though. What are you hearing? What are you thinking about? Because there's lots of other ideas that come up.
Well, it's an interesting thing because we were looking at crypto. I polled our audience at the Wealth Manager Forum that we held last week. And it was very much on my mind just to look at crypto in general, not because, as you rightly point out, there's investing, there's speculation. It's murky between the two. But when someone talks to me about Bitcoin or Ethereum or Cardano or something like that, I might think they have some thought behind it. If someone tells me they've punted loads of money into possibly less so now, but originally Dogecoin or Shiba or something like that, I mean, maybe long term it works out, but I think that stuff doesn't seem like a thought out idea. You know, investing in a token because it's got a fun name. That's what some people are doing. So I know that crypto as an asset class as a whole, you know, you're comparing apples and oranges a lot of the time. I don't think it's quite the same. But when I asked our audience about would they ever expect cryptocurrency to be in client portfolios, bear in mind that's, you know, regulated investing, I think only slightly under 20% said there was a possibility. No one said it's in client portfolios. Everyone else said they wouldn't really go near it. And I think just to flip that and just a blunt response from you, Greg, because we're out of time. Do you think there'll ever be a point when wealth managers are and advisors are just putting this in portfolios, or do you think that'll never happen?
It totally depends on regulation. Mm-hmm. I think if you had asked that question, given regulatory approval, I bet you'd have a higher number.
Yeah.
But because I have no idea if they'll ever approve it, I could work out. At the moment, I would lean towards they probably won't approve it for most regulated investment portfolios, for high net worth portfolios or things like that. But, you know, advisors can't even buy options for the most part. So when I'm seeing advisors can't buy put options to protect their clients' assets or buy call options for cheaper ways to get long-term growth, why would I think they're going to be able to buy cryptocurrencies anytime soon, right? So from a regulatory perspective, I don't think that. But that's where advisors are worried because that leaves a large portion of invested money outside of investable accounts and outside of it leaves a part of what an investor thinks of as the investment landscape outside of their kind of grasp, if you will. And we just believe so strongly in the advisor and the wealth manager and how much of a trusted position they have that we think it won't create that long of a large of a long-term problem. But I think it'll come in peaks and waves. Like right now, that it's back up high. I think people
the interest there.
Yeah,
yeah. You know, Doge is going to the moon. That's all you need to know, right? That's the FCA are big fans of that particular response. If you want to know why you've invested client money.
Yeah.
Anyway, Greg, I'm afraid we're out of time. But as always, a real pleasure to catch up with you. And thanks again for sharing your thoughts on the technology that we need to know about, and also about basketball NFTs. I think that was the real takeaway, right?
Absolutely. Well, thank you. This was awesome.
My pleasure. I've been Ian Horn. This has been The Wealth Tech Show. Do join me for the next episode where I'll be joined by renowned broadcaster and journalist Misha Glennie.